Good afternoon. So last time we talked about condition codes in x86. We mentioned that these were set by most arithmetic instructions and that the actual representation was the small set of bits giving us enough information for comparisons about the last arithmetic result, the zero flag, the sign flag, the overflow, and the carry flag, which tell us everything we need to know for all the conditional jump instructions. Then we moved on to talking about C. We reviewed what our types were, the sizes they have on the machines that we'll consider our reference system. Mentioned how Booleans work in C, namely that C doesn't really have a Boolean type. Talked a bit about pointers. We mentioned pointer arithmetic. So array indexing in C is really just taking a pointer and adding or subtracting to it. When we add or subtract to pointers, it takes into account the type being pointed to, so the compiler is responsible for scaling by the appropriate size. And then we started talking about command line. So before I move on, any questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so first, a logistical thing. So remember from the beginning of the semester, I said we would have quizzes. And I'd like to show you what those will look like. So let's pull up something that's like our quiz page. Obviously, the one you'll be using probably won't say example quiz one. So the way this works is when you take a quiz, it will ask you, do you really want to take it? The reason why it's saying that is because these quizzes have a time limit. You see our time limit here. If you have SDAC accommodations that give you extra time on exams and quizzes, your time will be scaled appropriately. But they have a time limit, and that time limit starts from when you open the quiz. You can go back to the quiz later on within that time, reopen your web browser, but the time limit still applies. So you open up the quiz, it will ask you if you really want to view it, and you'll get something like this. You can enter answers on the by actually aiming your mouse correctly and clicking. And when your answer is recorded, the box turns green. If the box stays yellow with a red border, your answer is not recorded. Something is wrong. Most commonly, you got logged out of NetBadge. Less commonly, something is wrong with our server. If it doesn't turn green, your answer is not recorded. If it does turn green, it is. There is a place to write comments here. We will have someone eventually read the comments. This is the place where if you think the question has multiple interpretations, please tell us. We will take that into account. We'll have someone read over the comments for anything that was wrong and decide whether that means you actually understood what was going on or you didn't. And you can go through all the questions. There is no submit button. Things are submitted when the box turns green. And you can go back to this, as I said, later on. So if you're here, you can go back. Let's give you one to view it again, and you'll see it, still see the answers you had recorded. Until the timeline, this continues ticking down after you go away. When the quizzes are done, you'll be able to see a page like this, which shows the correct answers after the due time and your score. When we have multiple people actually taking it, we'll also show you the answers of the class. That's what these percentages will be how many people gave answer each option in the class, so you can have an idea of how confused your fellow classmates were, or I can have an idea of how confused people were and know what I should probably review. So any questions on the logistics of taking quizzes? Yeah. So the questions are these open or closed notes. These are open book, open notes, open internet. Do not talk to other people about the questions. Do not IM other people about the questions. Don't post on Stack Overflow about the questions. But otherwise, open resources just with a time limit. Okay, so the first quiz is a pre-quiz for week three. It is on the reading. The reading is listed on the quiz description. It's also the week's reading for on the website schedule. It opens starting Saturday, and it's due before the first lecture for this class. I have them due before the first lecture because I don't want people taking the quiz during lecture. So, the close time is the last time you can submit the quiz. If you start this quiz Tuesday morning at 10:40, you have 5 minutes. So probably don't do that. Even though there's a time limit. Okay, and this is our quiz page. And how you get here is that if you go to our main website, there's a quizzes link at the top, and this is where it takes you. Okay, any questions about quizzes? Okay, so that's that, and just remember the first one is going to be out. Okay. So last time we were talking about things with the command line, and I believe I finished off by mentioning about the man for manual command, which lets you look up how commands and C library functions. You can look up with this. There's examples. Sometimes there's examples for commands and library functions, which is handy. I'd like to talk about a few particular commands that come up occasionally in this class. So another one I want to talk about is chmod, and you could try looking up the manual page for chmod. It's kind of confusing and isn't like really enough for most people to figure out what to do. What are file mode bits? What does that even mean? Turns out that it happens to do with what permissions do you have to do with a file. Can you read, can you write, or execute it? So I'll give an example on a slide for what that looks like. So here's an example chmod command. So I have an argument recursive. If you look it up on the man page, that means do not only just the file or directory I specify, but everything contained within it. Then I have this weird OG minus R and some directory. So what OG minus R, what this is an example, do? So the O stands for others. The G stands for the group that owns the file. For Portal and the NX machines, the group is typically basically students. The minus stands for remove some flags, and R stands for the ability to read. So this command makes everything in home user not readable by people who aren't the owners of the file. And surprisingly, this historically has not been the default setting for home directories on department servers, which is an interesting choice. But you can fix it if you want to. And the general form is that you can have U for user, G for group, O for others. You can remove permissions, you can add permissions, and the options are read, write, and execute. So one case where this comes up is that if you transfer the BOM and somehow it's not an executable file when you copy it from your machine, this is how you can fix that. You can U plus X, give me execute permission for this file that I transferred, but it wasn't executable when I transferred it. If you try to execute and you get permission denied, this is the fix. So the other notable thing, which you've all used for the BOM lab so far, is that we'll use tar a bunch. This is the standard archive utility. It stands for tape archive because when it was made, it was primarily intended for archiving things on tapes. Obviously not what we're using it for. We're not going to start handing out tapes of files to you and expecting you to read them with the tape drives you don't have. But that's where it comes from. And there's useful commands. So T stands for table of contents, X stands for extract, and C stands for create. And usually you'll use it with an F option for file, because if you don't specify F, it assumes you want to use your tape drive, which you probably don't have. So you specify F to mean a file. So TF is show the table of contents. So you can run this if you want to find out what will extracting this do. And I've also included a V on these commands. If you don't include V, it still works, but V stands for verbose. It causes it to actually list the files it created or added to the archive. Otherwise, you like type tar.xf and then it creates some files and you can try to figure that out by typing ls or something. And similarly with cf, it will add some files to the archive and you can use the table of contents to figure out what those are if you want to check. But I prefer knowing what those are directly. So any questions about tar? Okay, so tab completion. So something, just a quality of life thing in the shell that sometimes I see people do things like, this in the shell, no surprise, that doesn't work. And then they need to fix that, so they go. And so on. And you don't actually have to do that, so you can press the up arrow key, and that shows you your previous command, and you can edit the command with the arrow keys. So I can move my arrow back, add an I right here, and that command. So also, there's tab completion, which some people aren't aware of, which other thing. So rather than typing spring, I can type sp tab, and it completes what it can. It turns out there's multiple directories in my home directory, starting with spring 201. If I type tab again, tab twice, now it will show me what those options are. So I can look at one of them, and if I type something where there's only one thing, so I have CS3 is the name beginning of CS3330, that's the only CS3 directory in there. So if I type tab now, it completes that for me. This also applies to things like commands and arguments and files in the command line. So just want you to know it exists because it probably will save you time. And at least knowing history will save me watching people correcting like 120 character GCC commands by carefully retyping them. You don't have to do that. Yeah.
So I discovered by accident that in GDP I could hit enter and it automatically did step I. Is that because step I was the previous command and it repeats the previous command, or does it do a specific command?
So the question is, does GDB repeat the previous command when you press enter? I believe the answer is yes.
Okay.
And GDB, I think, also has similar line editing, but it's not the same thing. So that's just a quality of life thing we'd like you to know. So I hopefully don't watch people in office hours spending a minute retyping commands to fix a typo. Okay, so next I'm gonna have some things about C, some little things in C that are different than what you're probably used to in C++. So one is about structs. So structs in C++ are classes which are always public and that's it. In C, it's basically the same idea, except there's no private or protected in C, so it's public no matter what. And there's no member functions. You can't have functions and structs in C. They're just variables. And the syntax for struct looks like this here. That you declare a struct, struct rational, and then to use it, you type struct rational 2.5. That struct keyword is mandatory. You are not allowed to omit it. And you might say, well, that seems awfully inconvenient. I don't like typing struct all the time. Can I avoid that? The answer is yes, and there's a general mechanism that exists in both C and C++ that's typically used to do this called typedef. So, for example, let's say I want to declare a lot of unsigned ints. I could write unsigned int A, unsigned int B, unsigned int C, but I'd like something shorter than unsigned to type. I can do that with this typedef. And the way this works is I take something which looks like just a variable declaration for something called uint and put typedef in front of it. And what that says is that uint is another name for the type unsigned int. So now I can use uint to declare A, B, and C, and it means the same thing. So we're going to use this mechanism to avoid writing struct all the time. So what that's going to look like is here, that I declare struct with some name, and I typedef struct that name to rational. And now I can type rational. Questions in here? So, yeah.
Can you
back the slide? Yeah. So, a question on that, or?
I didn't catch the thought.
Okay. Good. So, this is just our thing. And you'll see C code which either deliberately always uses struct or which has a typedef for every struct. And for people who like having this typedef, this short name which doesn't have the word struct in it for every struct, there are other syntax you can use. And this is where things might get confusing here. So we can write these separate lines, or we can decide that, well, the way the struct syntax actually works is you know that there's a semicolon at the end? You might wonder, what is that semicolon for? Well, it turns out that with a normal struct declaration, you could put like x here and declare an instance x of the struct as a global variable. So that's what that's for. So we have our typedef where we're saying, here I'm declaring an instance rational of the struct, but I put typedef in front of it, so when I'm not declaring a variable rational of the struct, I'm saying rational is another name for the struct. And I can do that all in one line, and this is a common thing you'll see in C code. Now it's just the same as writing those two separate lines, but in one line. So questions? Far. So there's an even shorter form of this, which is common, which is might say, well, I really like writing rational. I never want to write struct anywhere but where I'm declaring the struct. Can I do that? And the answer is yes. You can just say I'm doing that, and you can omit the other name. And that is valid and something you will commonly see. Questions about this? Yeah?
Can we only do that once per file? Because then we'd be declaring multiple things labeled struct.
So the question is, can I only do this once per file? The answer is no. This struct has no name. It's not something with a blank name.
So we can have multiple things with no name.
Yeah, so you can have multiple structs with no name declared like this. As long as the typedef name is different, it's 100% fine, and you will commonly see C code which declares multiple structs like this in one file. So a note on the names here, that the name with the struct and the name without are separate names. So after these declarations, I can use the struct other name version or the rational version. I can't mix and match. Questions? Okay, so that's something which is a bit different than what you're probably used to from C++. So a note about structs, which is the same as in C++, but a lot of you have used Java more recently and may be used to how structs and classes work in Java, where there are references. They are not in C++ or C. So if I declare foo and bar, these are both going to be on the stack. They're both going to have their own copies of A, B, and C. Assigning foo to bar copies the elements. It doesn't make a reference. Changing bar will not change foo. Questions on this? This, as I said, should just be a reminder from 2150, but if you use Java, you're trained in the other way. It's not what's going to happen. Okay, so another thing reviewing in C. So first of all, here's a linked list. And this gives you an example of why you would need the alternate name for a struct. You might really like not writing struct. You're not really going to avoid that in this case. I can't write list star here because if I do that, it's not declared yet. So I have to write struct list underscore t because that exists at that point, but the type list doesn't until after the semicolon at the end. So to make this linked list, I need to use the struct keyword inside next declaration. So also, if we're doing linked list, in C++, you'd probably use new. In C, we don't have new, so instead we're going to use malloc. You may vaguely remember using malloc once in 2150. That's all we're going to have. So you malloc, you specify a size. Typically, you use the size of operator rather than trying to figure it out yourself. And when you're done with it, you use free like you would use delete in C++. And the same thing is going to apply later on to dynamic arrays. But questions before I move on here? Everyone, yeah.
Do we need to cast malloc to anything?
So the question is, don't I need a cast here? And in C, you do not. In C, you never need a cast to convert from a void star to any other type of non-function pointer. You can use a cast, it's not wrong, but I will not. Other questions? Okay, so dynamic arrays will also use malloc. We'll just supply the size of the array, which is going to be size of each element times how many elements we have. And because we use malloc to allocate it, we're going to use free to get rid of it. This is not like C++ where we have two versions of delete. There's one free function, no matter what you allocated with malloc. Malloc just doesn't know, you're just giving you a bunch of bytes of memory on the heap. And typically for an array, we're going to get a pointer to the first element, which is just a pointer to that space in memory, so there's no special conversion there. And we're using the pointer arithmetic we talked about last time, access the elements of the array. Yes.
What benefit is there to using a dynamic array instead of just normal?
So the question is, why would we use a dynamic array instead of one on the stack? So one benefit is that C, until very recently, did not support variable-sized arrays on the stack at all. Like, it was an error. Second benefit is that you can return a pointer to this array from a function. And you obviously can't do that for an array on the stack. Yes?
When you call free, does it actually delete that data, or just saying that memory is deallocated?
So the question is, when we call free, does it delete the data, or does it say the memory is deallocated? It makes the memory available for other things. How it does that is not specified and varies depending on exactly how malloc and free are implemented and what's happening on your system. Other questions? Okay. So one thing that you probably vaguely remember is that we have signed and unsigned types in C++ and also in C, of course. So unsigned types just means that we don't do choose complement, we just don't have a sign bit, So they can only store positive values. I'm giving the range on our reference machines. These might vary on other machines. And you can specify sign types with the sign keyword, though you will almost never see that. And you can specify unsigned ints by just typing unsigned, which you will sometimes see. So I'd like to note about one little thing that comes up with sign types, and that's what this does. So who can tell me, what answer would I expect here? What should, logically speaking, this print out? Over there? Yeah.
Logically, it would print out
True. And what, how do we represent true in C?
One.
And that would make sense because -1 is less than 0. That's what we expect this to print out. And if you run this code, it will print out 0. We'll print that out every time, everywhere. And you might say, well, that doesn't make any sense. Someone screwed up. And arguably true. So let me first give the practical piece of advice is don't do this. And what we're doing wrong is comparing signed and unsigned values. And the easy fix is cast to a type which can hold all the values. Now, a good question is, why didn't the compiler do this for us? What shouldn't the compiler be doing this for us? Isn't that what makes sense to do when we're comparing an unsigned int and a signed int and longs hold everything? Why isn't that happening? Well, the compiler is following a bunch of rules that multiple compiler manufacturers and other people agreed on for what C should do. And those rules work as follows. They said, when you're comparing two values, first, convert the two values to the same type. Okay, so what type do we convert them to? You would say probably long makes the most sense. That's not what the rules say. The rules say, if all the values fit in ints, convert them to ints. Well, that's not true here because not all the values we can represent with an unsigned int fit in an int. So then the rules say, otherwise, choose one of the operand types to convert to. Don't choose another type. And just whichever one appears first on this list. So are any of them an unsigned long? No. Are any of them a long? No. Are any of them an unsigned int? Yes. Well, convert them both to an unsigned int. So that's what the C rules say the compiler has to do. And it faithfully does that. So it converts x to an unsigned int. We get this the most positive possible number. And that is not going to be less than 0. And so the output is 0. Yeah?
Why doesn't int fit all the possible values?
So why doesn't int fit all the possible values? So here's the range of values that fit in an unsigned int versus an int. You can see the maximum is higher. So there's some values that fit in an unsigned int which don't fit in an int. So other questions? OK, so a good question is, who's responsible for this stupid rule? You know, why are we doing this? So this has to do with how C evolved. So originally, there was one implementation of C. And this was sort of documented in a book called The C Programming Language. And this version of C is known as KNRC, after the authors of the book. And this version of C was actually very, very different from the C you're used to. For example, if you ever see code written in this style, all the function declarations are completely different. But later on, a lot of people wanted to implement C and were interested. And they wanted to improve the language a bit. So a bunch of people who were writing C compilers or using C came together, along with the American National Standards Institute, and they wrote a standard specifying this is what C is, and all the compiler writers would implement that. And the idea is that you could take the C code on one platform, use it on another, and everyone would have implemented this standard, and that would be fine. And this was done in 1989. The International Standards Organization picked up the standard in 1990, so you'll hear this called variously C89 for the ANSI standard, or C90 for the ISO standard, which is basically the same thing. And on your compiler, if you pass minus and C, you're asking for this version of C. You're saying, please support this version of C as close as possible. Or you can pass minus standard equals C90 should GCC request the same thing. And this mostly looks like modern C. And the standard has continued to be updated. So in 1999, there was a notable revision, which you can request with a different compiler option. And this adds some features you probably thought were always part of C, but in fact weren't, such as declaring variables in the middle of a block that is not immediately after a set of braces, that in C 90, in the 1990 version of C, that was not allowed. You could only declare variables immediately after some set of braces. And supporting slash slash comments. That was not in the original 1990 version of C. And they've continued to update it. So we're not going to talk about many real features of C that weren't in the 1990 version of the standard. But the standard existing explains a lot of why compilers do what they're doing. They are following the rules in the standard, where the idea is that that specifies what a compiler does, and that's what they're implementing, even in cases where maybe the rules in the standard aren't so great. They're going to still follow those rules to make sure they're doing the same thing as other compilers. And the standard is not going to change those rules very much because they're not particularly happy about saying that, sorry, your code that was written for the C standard is not going to work anymore. So the rules are often stuck the way they are. So there's a particular issue which comes up because of this, known as undefined behavior. And here I have an example of code which has undefined behavior. But first, what do you think this should print out? What is the most sensible thing for this to print out?
One.
So who says one? Who says zero is the most sensible thing? Okay. Someone went to argue for one? Yeah.
Because algebraically speaking, if you solve it, one is always greater than zero.
Okay, so you're saying it should print out one, because when we add one to something, that's greater, bigger than what we started with. Okay? And who wants to argue for zero? Yeah.
If we started the max and add one, we wrap around.
Yeah. You might say, I know how choose complement works. When we start at the maximum integer, it wraps around. And, well, you might say, okay, so what did my compiler choose? Well, when I compile without optimizations, I get zero. And I compile with enough optimizations, I get one. So a good question is, well, we have this standard which says what compiler should do. What does that say? And the answer is the standard doesn't. It calls this undefined behavior. It says the compiler can do whatever it wants. So first, let's talk about why is the compiler doing these two different things? What's happening? And we can look at the assembly code that's generated. So in the case where if I turn on enough optimizations, the compiler has done the algebra. It did the algebra and said, well, we subtract number from both sides, we get one greater than zero, that's always true. Why do I even do the comparison? I'm just going to return one. It's much faster, simpler. That sure is convenient for the compiler to be able to do that. In the other case, the compiler actually does the computation, it adds one, using the LEA instruction, does the comparison, uses this setL instruction, which copies from the condition codes into a byte register, and then returns that value. Yeah?
One thing that I'm not too sure about is like who wrote the compiler, and also like how is it like random? Like, does it just randomly decide things based on a random number?
So the question is, so who wrote the compiler? A lot of people wrote, in this case I use GCC, a lot of people wrote GCC over many, many years. As for how the decision is made, in this case, it depends what optimization options I pass to GCC. So sometimes I pass flags to GCC which said, hey, I want you to do optimizations where you do some algebra. And it did some algebra. and figured out that it's always one. In other cases, I passed didn't pass those flags, so it did some optimizations to make this assembly a little cleaner, but it didn't do the algebra, so it just generated the code which actually adds one, and that wrapped around. Does that make sense? Yeah. So the question is, if you pass the same flags every time you get the same result, mostly, not guaranteed. And this is something which like could vary between like minor compiler versions. And yes, compilers are not completely deterministic often, at least by default. So we're talking a lot about what the compiler does. Let's talk about what the standard says for this. And the standard says that when we have overflow of a signed integer, so in this case I'm taking int max, I'm adding one to it, and I'm doing this with ints, so that's outside the range of what ints can store, that it's undefined behavior, which means the compiler can do whatever it wants. And by whatever it wants, we don't just mean giving the wrong answer. That is not what the only thing the compiler can do. The compiler can crash your program. It can generate code which segfaults for this case. That is a valid compiler output according to the standard. You might find that useful. Maybe it's useful to know if there's wraparound and you want it to crash, or you may not. But the standard lets the compiler generate the wrong answer or just crash or something else. And there's a bunch of things for which the standard has decided we don't care about compilers handling this in any particular way. We'll let them do whatever they want. And one of these is signed integer overflow. For unsigned numbers, it does what you expect. It wraps around that is required. For signed numbers, the compiler can do whatever it wants. And you can see the motivation for it is that it enables optimizations like this, that the compiler can do this sort of algebra to optimize the code without having to check every single time, is this going to wrap around? Is this going to wrap around at every step of that algebra? And that's sort of an advantage of this choice, but the disadvantage is now our code behaves inconsistently and possibly in even more extreme ways. So another example of undefined behavior is out-of-bounds array accesses. The standard just says they're undefined, not that they do anything in particular, that they can do whatever they want. So you've seen they often segfault, they sometimes don't. And typically what happens is the compiler just generates code that uses whatever is in memory there, and who knows what that does, to give the compiler that flexibility and not require the compiler to like check the bounds every time. They just said it's undefined behavior. You're going outside the bounds of an array or using an invalid pointer. Another example is integer divide by zero. The standard could have said like this always crashes the program, but they decided that they're going to give compilers the flexibility to do whatever is most convenient. So if the divide instruction triggers something like a segfault, that's probably what will happen. If it silently just gives you a zero, you'll probably get a zero. Another example is writing read-only data, or an out-of-bounds shifts, which we'll probably talk about later today. So you might say, why is there this undefined behavior? So one of the things is these optimizations. The other is that different architectures work differently, and this allows the standard to ignore those cases and let the compiler do what's most convenient. Like, as I mentioned, if you have an architecture where the divide instruction just ignores divide by zeros, well, now the compiler can use that because it doesn't have to crash for a divide by zero, which means it doesn't have to generate code to check if it's zero. You just assume it's not. Okay. Any questions about this? Undefined behavior. Okay, so. And let's go on to our next topic. So I have a problem I'd like to solve in C. And that's given the number hex OXAB, I want to get A. I want to get the first hexadecimal digit of the number. So how can I do that? Someone give me a way I can do that. And as a hint, you can do this with things you definitely already know about only, and it might help to think about how bases work. So, back there, yeah.
Off the top of my head, I'm thinking you can do a bit shift.
So a bit shift is a way. Now that's something that not everyone might remember, but that is a way, and we'll talk about that. There's another way of doing it, which is something you definitely have used even more often. Yeah.
Subtract mod with 16.
So subtracting mod with 16, that would get us OXA0. So not quite, but mod is a good idea. So there's something related to mod which we can do. Yeah.
Divide by 16.
And it happens that division in C rounds down. So this is a way we can do that. And this is a way you should already know in any programming language how to do something that you've probably used the divide operator before at least once, I'm assuming. So division is great, and in fact, usually has an assembly instruction on a modern machine. But it turns out that that assembly instruction is really slow. So on my desktop, which runs the Skylake version of the Intel processor, it takes about 6 cycles per division. Now, clock cycles are really fast, so that's not like super slow. But if we compare that to something like addition, the same machine can do 4 additions per cycle. So division is 24 times slower than addition. And this gets much worse if we're talking about not dividing a byte, but dividing an 8-byte value. And something we can observe about this case is that it's much simpler. That if you think about how the value is represented on the machine, we have a set of wires that are holding the bits of the value. And typically, we represent values on those wires with, you know, voltage. And we're just ignoring some of the wires and taking 4 wires that correspond to the hex digits. If you remember how hexadecimal works, we can take each digit of a hexadecimal value, convert it to bits separately to convert a value to binary. So that means each hexadecimal digit corresponds to 4 bits. So what we're actually doing is if we take here 7 and 2, we have our 7. It's just these top 4 bits. And that's what we want. And in hardware, this would be really easy. In hardware, all we're doing is ignoring some wires. We're just cutting some wires. And it's free. So something we want to do is expose this simplicity to software. That we don't want people to do some really complicated operation like division to get at what's really simple in hardware. And so the operation we're going to expose is going to be, let's chop off the last few bits of a number. So that's going to be a shift right operation. We're going to move the number over to the right. And on x86, this is the SHR instruction. So it takes an amount to shift by, a number of bits, and a register, and it moves that register that many bits over. Now, of course, we have a problem here, which is that if I just move the bits over, the register doesn't change size. I don't turn my 32-bit register into a 24-bit register, or 26, you know, I can't do that. So we need to put something in the top bits of the register, and we need to make some sort of choice about this. And what this instruction does, this SHR instruction does, is it puts zeros in. Just an arbitrary choice, and it happens to be a useful one for implementing that divide by 16 we showed you earlier. That you don't want random numbers in the top of your byte, you want zeros there. It's exactly what we want for that. So this means we can implement our getTopNibble function with this assembly. So first I need to take my 1-byte argument, move it over to my return value, which is an int, and then shift that over. write by 4. So questions about what I did here? Okay, so we also have a way of asking for this directly in C. It turns out that if there's the shift operator, which you may also know as the insertion operator for Cin, it's the same operator, but on integers, the shift operator is, in this case, this is the right shift operator. It represents the right shift operation. So I can write my get top nibble to represent this as value greater than 4. That's shift over by 4. And a compiler might generate assembly like this. Okay. So now we have two ways of writing this function in C. So these two options, which will produce the same answer. And it seems like, okay, we saved a division, so that's going to be much better. And you might say, so I should be really careful that when I'm doing like this divide by 16 stuff, I actually do a shift. And the answer is, well, the compiler knows about this. The compiler is made by people who already learned about this trick, and they've written that code in the optimizer. So if you turn on optimizations, it knows. It'll do it. It's going to figure out, yeah, that's the same as a shift dividing by 16. Now, where it won't do it is if we were dividing by like a global variable that happened to be 16. If it doesn't know that's 16, it's going to generate a divide instruction. It has to handle if it's like 7 and do the slower thing. But where it's a constant, the compiler knows about this, and this is what the compiler will generate, rather than the slow divide instruction, because it knows that this is really beneficial, and it's actually a very simple optimization to implement. Okay. Yeah?
Are there tricks for numbers that aren't powers of 2, or is this just for this?
So the question is, can we use this for numbers which aren't powers of 2? There are things like this the compiler can do for numbers which aren't power of 2. They are not obvious. One of them will come up much later in the semester. Yeah?
If, say, we're dividing by 6, is it any faster to divide by 2 with the shift and then divide by 3, or is it faster to just do the one instruction?
So the question is, if we are dividing by 6, is it faster to do the divide by 2 part of that with the shift instruction and then a normal divide? Probably not. There is the code you'll likely see generated for dividing by a constant 6 is probably going to use a different trick that we're not going to talk about today that involves multiplying by the reciprocal. I believe it's described in your textbook too, somewhere. Okay, so this rate shift is equivalent to dividing by powers of 2. So for any power of 2, we can shift by the appropriate amount, and it's the same as dividing by that power of 2 or multiplying by 2 to the minus something and rounding down. Okay, so far I've shown you this rate shift. We shifted in these zeros. So let's talk about some example here. There's something we haven't dealt with, which is negative numbers. So here's some code. Here's some assembly code, which shows that shift write instruction that shifts in zeros. What's the result when we pass negative 2 to this? And I'll give you a minute or so to figure it out. who needs more time? A couple people, okay.
No, it's possible. I actually do
Okay, who needs more time now? Three. Okay, so who thinks it's A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H? Okay, I think it is F. Anyone want to tell me what particular large positive number it might be? So you're saying it's going to be, I'll write this, so we have our foo of 2 where foo is shift right. Yeah, and you're saying the large positive number is going to be this? So that number? Okay, so this number?
No, like the first one is 0.
Okay, that. Okay, so that's what we're going, okay. Any other ideas? Yeah.
7 FFF.
Okay.
No.
That one?
Is it only?
This is 32 bits because we have EAX. Yeah?
Can I give it in binary?
What?
Can I give it in binary?
Sure.
0, 1, then 29 zeros, and then a 1.
0, 1,
and then 29 zeros, and then a 1.
And 29 zeros, okay. Like that? Okay. So we have a bunch of opinions here. These are all different numbers. So something we need to know to figure this out is, well, we need to remember about 2's complement. So one thing, I guess the big thing people remember about 2's complement is the flip all the bits and add one rule. Other ways you can think about it are that we have a loop of numbers here. We add one, we go around, and eventually we wrap around from the most positive number to the most negative number. And minus one is all ones. Minus two is going to be all ones except for the least significant digit. Another way we can remember it is the flip all the bits and add one. One, so this is negation in 2's complement. Let's flip all the bits and add one. So let's work through the bit representation that we have here. So we start with negative 2. So to get negative 2, we start with 2, which is a bunch of zeros, and then 0, 1, 0. We flip all the bits of that, so we get a bunch of ones, and then 1, 0, 1. And then we add 1, and we get a bunch of 1s, and we carry a 1 here, so we get 1, 0. And that's negative 2.
7 FFFFFE.
So that's negative 2. We haven't finished yet. And now we're going to shift right by 1. We're going to shift this right by 1. So we're going to move this over by 1. And when we do that, this last bit is discarded by the shift. So we end up with a 0 because that's our what is shifted in. Filler. And then a bunch of 1s, and then 1111 because the 0 got shifted off. And what's this in complement? Well, we can see it on our picture here. It's, in fact, this most positive possible number. We could also have figured out what it is by applying the same rule. We take our mystery value, we have this. Well, yeah, we could figure out what it is by doing, yeah, by looking at the place. It's 2 to the 30 times plus 2 to the 30, 29, and so on. We could figure it out that way. So this is the equal to, it turns out, maxims. And so the actual return value is maxint, which hopefully counts as a large positive number. So any questions about how I did this? Yes?
Yeah, so for the assembly instruction for shift right, why is there an L? Like, what does that stand for?
So what's the L stand for? So if you remember, this was this was for long, this is the 4 bytes. Remember, if we had shift Q, it would be quad, would be 8 byte. That's what it's for. And technically, we can omit it here because we know EAX is always 4 bytes. So I could just write SHR instead. Other questions? Okay, so we see we got not the right answer for a shift with that. So let's think about, well, maybe I want to do my divide by 16 with negative numbers and have it work. Can I do that? And let's think about what dividing by 2 actually looks like for a negative number. And we're going to do this with 2's complement. So we're saying we're starting off with a negative number, which is minus x. So one way I can definitely use my shift operator to divide that by 2 is first convert it to the positive number, then use the shift, then convert it back. So I start with x, I flip all the bits and add 1 to get minus x to get positive x. I write shift to get x divided by 2, which we know works and rounds down. And then I flip all the bits and add 1 to get negative x divided by 2. So something you can observe is that the last operations here are we right shift over 1, which adds some zeros to the top bits of the number, and then we flip those bits. So this is the same as if we just right shifted without flipping both twice, but added in 1s instead of zeros. Except that we have this add 1 operation. So if we ignore the adding 1, we're flipping the bits, shifting, flipping the bits. That's all we're doing, and flipping the bits and shifting adds in some zeros, and then we flip them back to 1s, and that's the only difference between this shifting. The only difference is that instead of adding in zeros, we add in 1s. And if you think about our prior example, that if we had only added in not a 0 here, but a 1, we would get negative 1, which is what we expect for negative 2 divided by 2. So if we just added in a 1, we would have gotten the right answer. And we can come across that conclusion here by noticing that basically dividing by 2 is the same as shifting, but adding in 1s instead of zeros for negative numbers. So something that would be useful given this is a version of shift that sometimes shifts in 1s and sometimes shifts in zeros. And in fact, this is something we have on our x86 machine. There's a different shift instruction called an arithmetic shift. The other type of shift is called a logical shift, which shifts in based on the sign bit. So it copies the sign bit rather than always shifting in zero. So if our number starts out as positive, it does the same thing the shift we saw before did. But if it starts off as negative, we copy the sign bit, and that's what we shift in. So we have these two possibilities. And because these are different shift operations, we have to have different instructions for them, because we can't just specify them with one. So any questions on this operation? And this other shift is going to be like dividing by two. Yes?
Is there an SAL? And would it put the sign bit on the other end?
So the question, is there an SAL? The answer is yes, and it's not particularly useful.
Okay.
So other questions? And we'll get to left shift later. So, but for right shift, we have the arithmetic version and the logical version. So this is the arithmetic version, which is more like dividing by two or a power of two. But as we mentioned, one thing we neglected was this rounding. We add one here and add one here, and that's going to change the rounding, and we'll talk about how in a bit. So we have this shift operation. You might say, okay, that's great. Can I use this from C? And the answer is yes. So if you have a signed value, like an int assigned, then the left shift operator in C does an arithmetic shift. If you have an unsigned value, it does a logical shift. So, and that's how you select between, is just by making sure you supply the right kind of type to your shift. So this is what's going to be true in practice on our machines, on any machine you'll have access to, but the rules in the C standard are not so kind. So signed right shift actually falls into a category known as implementation defined. The C standard says compilers can do either one, they just need to document which one they do. But every machine I know of does this arithmetic shift for signed and a logical one for unsigned, but technically it's not required by the standard. Also, related to what the standard says, there is a piece of undefined behavior that comes up here, that if the shift amount is greater than the width of the type, the behavior is undefined. So you would expect that if you did something like x over 64 with a long, long x, that the result of this should be 0. But in fact, it's undefined behavior. Or x is positive, I should say, like x equals, like you'd expect that to be 0. It's actually undefined behavior, not long, long, sorry, just long x. You'd expect that to be 0 because you're taking 100, dividing it by 2 to the 64. Of course, that, or shift moving in all zeros, but that's not how it works. And the reason why, most likely, is that on x86, when you do a variable width shift, it only uses the lower bits of the shift amount. So if you're shifting a 64-bit value, it says, well, you can shift by at most 63, so I'm only going to use 5 bits to determine how much to shift. So it just ignores the upper bits in the hardware. And rather than having compilers generate code to check for that case, the C standard just said it can do whatever. So it's undefined behavior. So don't do it, even though you think it should work. And it should give you 0 or negative 1. Yes?
So then we could just in 2 steps do like shift by 63 and then shift by 1, and that would work fine.
Yes. Yeah, the question is, you can do shift by 63, shift by 1? Yeah, that would work and give you the result, give you always the right result. Okay. So since we've talked about how we have this different arithmetic shift, let's talk about how it works and start to tackle the rounding issue. So here I have my shift function, and here are this shift by 2. I pass negative 6, what result do I get? And let me correct, this should be, that should be an F, not an E, and this should be a G here. But yeah, just figure out what you think the answer is. We'll go over in a sec. You can check with your neighbor, you're allowed to speak. Who needs more time? So who thinks the answer is A, -4, B, C, D, okay, E, F, and, okay, or sorry, yeah, and G, sorry, remembering things. So, okay, so majority seem to think -1, some -2, which is about the rounding issue. So we know it's like dividing by 4. 6 divided by 4 is 3/2, which can round to 2 or 1. Now, if this were a division in C, we know that it would round towards 0. That's how rounding works in C. So the question is that what the shift operator ends up doing. So let's figure it out systematically. So I'm going to first start by saying what's -6 in binary? So 6 in binary is going to be a bunch of zeros and 1, 1, 0. We have our 4 and our 2 in our ones place. So 4 plus 2 is 6. And then we flip all the bits of this and add 1. Which gives us a bunch of ones, and a 10. So that's -6. And when we're shifting by 2, we're going to discard 2 bits from this. So these are discarded by shift. And we're going to add in 2 copies of the sign bit. So we're going to copy the one here, the sign bit. So this is the copy shift. So we get a bunch of ones, and then 110 as our number. So we need to figure out, okay, what is that actually? And we can flip all the bits to negate it and add 1. And we find out that that was -2. 2, so this must have been -2, so that was our result. Assuming I didn't mess up. So note that if we think about C, in C, -6 divided by 4 is -1, because C rounds towards 0. But that's not the answer we got. So yes, we do division, but we do division with different rounding for negative numbers. So questions about how I got my answer? Are you figuring this out? So you might say, okay, so that means compilers can't do this for, can't do the thing where we saw for dividing by 16, they generated the exact same code that you get with shift. That means they can't do that for this, right? That we should change all our sign divides into shifts to make them much faster. Well, compilers still will do it, but they'll make some adjustments for the rounding. So this is the code GCC generates. If you have a function which just divides by 8, it adds 7 to the value if it's negative to make the rounding work out. And that's still faster than doing a divide operator on at least my desktop. Yeah?
So compilers can't do that.
Yeah.
So just to clarify, in C we have -1, but in here we have -2.
So in C, if you use the divide operator, you'd get -1.
Okay.
With the code, the C code there gives you -2. Okay, and just to preview what we'll start with next time. So we talked about shifting to remove values. Another thing you want to do is move values over, so like changing OXA to OXA0. And that's, we can do with multiplication, but there's a much simpler operation in the hardware. We just add some wires, which is free. And we want to expose that same thing in software. And you might say, well, let's just shift left by a negative amount. That seems like a great idea. Sadly, not a valid operation. Not allowed in C, not allowed in assembly. So we have a shift left operator that goes in the other direction, and a corresponding C operator. And that's what we'll pick up next time.